Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The court is now in session. The judges are Judge Bratvold, Judge Gaitis, Judge Larson. The Honorable Theodora Gaitis presiding.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals this November 17th, 2022. The panel has six cases scheduled on its calendar today. Four of those cases are scheduled for argument, for oral argument. We are holding oral arguments today via the Zoom platform. It's been a while, I think, for everyone. I would just ask that everyone keep their mute button on if they're not speaking, including the attorneys. And I will give the attorneys a little more information before they begin their arguments. But first, I'll call the first case on our calendar. It is Ashley Burgess versus Kevin Lund, 8220360. And Ms. Graves and Ms. Fisher, you look like you are ready to go. I will just let you know a few little rules that we have here, which I'm sure you already know. Appellant will have 15 minutes to present an argument. Respondent will have 15 minutes, and then appellant will have a 5-minute rebuttal, regardless of how much time is used. There's a clock on the screen that will count your time down, and you can just nod for me if you wouldn't mind if you can see that clock. Okay, thank you. We are making an audio recording of your arguments this morning, and to that effect, I would ask that you please introduce yourself and the party you're representing before you begin your arguments. And with that, we are ready to go. We will begin with counsel for appellant.
Thank you, Your Honor. Oops, my chair is moving. Excuse me. I am the attorney for the appellant in this matter, Kevin Lund. Your Honor, we are here today to ask the court to reverse and remand a decision from the St. Louis County District Court, which denied Mr. Lund's motion to modify the parenting time schedule. We're asking that the case be remanded to the trial court and that the trial court judge be instructed in her new decision to address the issue of what the best interest of the children, the 25% parenting time presumption, and my client's request that a holiday schedule be included in the party's parenting time schedule. As indicated in our briefs, Your Honor, the parties are the parents of two boys, Cedric, who is 16, and Elliot, who is 10. They were divorced in 2021, I believe, or excuse me, 2020. They, at the time, they were living in Duluth. In April of 2021, the respondent, Ms. Burgess, moved the children to Wayzata here in the Twin Cities. And then in September of 2021, my client brought a motion to modify the schedule in part because of the changes that had occurred because of that motion, of that move. The trial court judge denied my client's motion and in doing so applied an incorrect legal standard to deny his motion. This is one of those cases, Your Honor, where the parties don't disagree on that issue. Counsel for a respondent has acknowledged both in a motion and in her brief that the trial court in modifying a motion for parenting time should have used the standard for modification of parenting time under Minnesota statute 518.175, subdivision 5, as opposed to Minnesota statute 518.18, which is the more stringent standard that a party must meet to actually change the custody labels in a matter. And in this case, the trial court judge used the custody standard and denied the motion. So again, there's no dispute that the best interest standards needs to be addressed, and that the court on remand needs to address what those best interest factors are and how they apply to this case. The best interest standards, for the court's information, is found in 518.17.
So counsel, here's my question.
Sure.
So if the parties both agree that the 518.175 standard needs to be applied, aren't all of the other errors, like not looking at parenting time, the vacation, the 25%, the best interest, aren't all of those derived from the original legal error? So shouldn't we just, I mean, isn't one option here for the court to simply remand back to the district court to apply the correct standard?
That is one option, Your Honor. However, the 25% presumption and the requirement of the inclusion of a holiday schedule are separate provisions under the parenting time statute under 518.175. And so they must be addressed in addition to the best interest standard. And specifically, I believe it's subdivision 1G requires that there be a presumption that my client is entitled to 25% parenting time. And if he wants a specific holiday schedule, he's entitled to it.
But I guess if we see the concession that's happened in this case is that it's generally Minnesota statute 518.175 that needs to be applied, then don't all of those error, why isn't the appropriate remedy for us to remand for the district court to apply that whole statute instead of, you know, deciding some of these legal issues?
Well, that would certainly be an appropriate option, Your Honor. In this case, those happen to be the specific parts of the statute that are in dispute, because there are other parts of the statute that are not relevant to my client's motion. And related to that, Your Honor, is really what would the scope of remand be? If you look at appellant or respondent's brief, their real concern is that they don't want the trial court to be allowed to take any additional evidence if the matter is remanded to the trial court. And they argue that in the case of Shum, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, versus Shum, 510 Northwest 2nd 13, the Court of Appeals denied the mother's request that she be allowed to reopen the record on remand. But I would point out that in that case, the Court of Appeals denied the motion, the mother's motion, to set aside the original decision. So there really wasn't any basis to reopen the record in the first place. There is another more recent case from the Minnesota Supreme Court, Woolsey, W-O-O-L-S-E-Y versus Woolsey, 975 Northwest 2nd 502, which we believe is more applicable to this case as far as what the scope of remand be. In that case, the father had brought a motion to modify legal custody. The Minnesota Supreme Court determined that the trial court had used the incorrect legal standard to decide that motion, as here. And in making their remand, the Minnesota Supreme Court gave the trial court the discretion whether to reopen the record and on appeal. And of note in that case was that it had been 2 years since the appellant had filed his motion in that case. And Your Honor, like here, in this case, by the time it gets back to the trial court, it will be about 18 months since my client filed his motion. And that is a long time in the life of two children. And a lot of things can change, and the trial court can make a better and more informed decision if she knows what's been going on, particularly because in this case, my client filed his motion only for about 4 months after mom moved. And the parties didn't have the benefit of seeing how this move affected the school year schedule and all the other changes that my client is asking for.
Ms. Grace, just one question.
Sure.
So are you asking us to remand to the district court with discretion to reopen the record, or are you asking us to order the district court to reopen the record for the purpose of taking additional evidence?
Your Honor, our request would be the latter, that they be instructed, but at a minimum, that the trial court be given the discretion to reopen the record, which is what they did in Woolsey. I would point out, Your Honor, that You know, unlike a motion to modify custody, parenting part-time motions can be brought as frequently as parents want them to. There's no restriction because, like, with the motion to modify custody, you're prohibited from bringing another motion within 2 years after one is denied. There aren't any restrictions in a motion to modify parenting time. And so just for no other reason than judicial economy, you know, because otherwise, if the record isn't reopened, my client has to bring another motion and bring up all the additional things that have happened over the past year and a half. And why not just get it all done at the same time? And this time the court will have the instructions from this court on what the proper legal standards are for the court to use. I would note that in the event the court doesn't reopen the record on remand, that it is our position, and this is argued in our brief, that Ms. Burgess, her affidavit did not address the presumption that my client is entitled to 25% parenting time. And she didn't provide, she didn't address it. She didn't argue that it wasn't in the children's best interest. So really, as is, unless something new comes up, there is no basis in our in the existing record to deny my client that request. And then, you know, similarly with the holiday schedule, the respondent is.
But counsel, isn't it your client's, I mean, your client brought the motion, so isn't it your client's burden to show that it's in the best interest of the child based on the current record?
Your Honor, as I read the statute, it is in, there is a presumption. And he's, you know, it's there. It's a it says that there's a rebuttable presumption. And it's really the burden of the opposing party to present evidence that it is not in the children's best interest for there to be a 25% schedule.
Is that true even in circumstances? Is that true even in circumstances like this where there was an agreement between the parties previously that how does the presumption work in a case like this when there was a previous agreement between the parents about the 25%, less than 25% parenting time?
Sure. Well, Your Honor, there's actually a Court of Appeals decision that we've discussed in our brief, which addresses that. It's the Hagen case. I'm looking at my notes here and I don't see a citation for it, but I believe it was Hagen versus Shermer. And in that case, the Court of Appeals specifically stated that even if the parties had originally agreed to a less than 25% parenting time schedule, that presumption still applies on a motion to modify. So it's essentially you start all over again. And I know we discussed that in our brief. I just don't have the citation off the top of my head. So, and Your Honor, the holiday schedule, especially, that really should not be a difficult decision for the trial court to make, because it is mandatory that when a party requests it, that a holiday schedule with duration and frequency be included. Respondent argues that because my client didn't include a specific schedule that the court can't, that he's waived his right. I'm not quite sure what that argument is, but my client did in his argument. He was pro se at the time, but he did ask for an alternating holiday schedule. And, you know, I think if you're a district court judge and you're hearing these cases, you typically would know what kind of, the major holidays that parties would usually alternate. And my client is entitled to that. It would be in the children's best interest, and that should be addressed. So, Your Honor, we had one final issue that was a small issue concerning the order that the district court ordered my client to pay his child support and spousal maintenance through a direct deposit to the respondent's bank account. The family law statutes family law is, you know, it's governed by statute. There is no, all of the remedies for collecting child support and spousal maintenance are set forth in section 5118A. There is no such provision that allows the court to order that. Counsel for respondent argued that there were two old cases from 1985 and 1986, which gave the court the authority to order that money be set aside in trust, and that then the payments would be made from that trust, and that somehow that would give the court the authority to do what it did in this case. However, there is a separate statute, 518A.71, which specifically allows the court to order sequestration of a person's income and set it aside to be used to pay child support if child support hasn't been paid. But my client was current on his support, so this statute didn't apply, and there is no basis in our that we know of in the law to do this. So we're asking the court to reverse the decision of the trial court, remand it to the court, preferably to take additional evidence for all the reasons that I've stated, and to apply the correct legal standards. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Graves. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Next, we will hear from counsel for respondent. Let's just wait one moment to get your clock reset. Okay, you can begin whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honors. So my name is Leah Fisher. I am counsel representing the respondent on this appeal, Ashley Burgess. It's already been identified, and I think it's clear already today that we've already agreed that this matter may be remanded to the district court for additional findings on all of the issues, frankly. I think that the order was decided correctly, but the district court judge did not make the findings that were needed to be done. I think that the issue before this court today is whether a remand should include instruction to the district court to make any specific rulings, or whether it's just an instruction to take additional evidence or to hold some other kind of proceeding. Our position is that this matter should just be remanded back to the district court to make additional findings based on the record that was before it at the time of the hearing. The record before the district court at that time was complete. The proceedings arose on appellant's motion, as we've already discussed, and he did bear the burden of proof to prove that the modification was necessary on all of the issues that were raised in his motion. At the district court, both parties filed written motions, affidavits. The appellant had the opportunity to submit a written letter along with documents that he felt supported his case or were otherwise needed by the court to make a decision on his motions. Both parties argued their motions to the court at the hearing, and the transcript shows that appellant had the opportunity to answer additional questions from the district court judge to further support his motion or to address the motions that were made in my client's counter motion. Appellant really had a full and fair opportunity to present his case to the district court judge. And I think he's seeking a second bite at the apple with this appeal and also asking for additional testimony, additional proceedings at the district court level.
Counsel, how do you respond to appellant's argument that it would be not the judicial economy would be served by, at a minimum, giving the district court discretion to reopen the record, given that another motion to modify parenting time could simply be filed again?
Yeah, and I think there is a technical, an evidentiary issue that goes along with that, which speaks to fairness and an opportunity for my client, which is that if the motion is decided simply on the evidence presented before the court has the opportunity to correct her ruling and issue an order that's based on the correct statute. If then the appellant wants to bring a subsequent motion to change parenting time or custody or whatever it is that he's seeking to do, the evidence that will be presented to the court at that time will be limited to what's happened since the time of the last motion. rather than compounding all of these, the same facts and circumstances that the court has already heard about in the last motion. The court already has the information that it needs to decide that motion without additional information.
My concern, counsel, is just a quick follow-up on that. And again, it was mentioned by appellant's counsel. We have a time lag here, so I don't quibble with your description of the record at the time that the motion was made and heard by the district court as being complete. I think that might be the word you used. But I am concerned, given that the correct standard is the best interests of the children, and time has passed, right? And so perhaps, we don't know, that's why we would trust the district court's discretion. Time has passed, and we're not in a good position to assess whether new evidence is required or appropriate to us to make that decision to modify or not under the best interest standard. So would you address that, please?
Yeah, and my understanding is that the district court would always have the discretion to take additional evidence if the district court judge felt that that was necessary. I don't think that the district court will find that it's necessary. At this point in time, we're about a year out from that motion hearing. Although Mr. Lund made his motion before that, the evidence that was put before the court was probably current until about a year ago. I don't know that additional evidence is needed, and I don't believe that the court needs additional evidence to make their decision. Additionally, one other point that I think is important regarding this need or not for additional evidence is that the proceedings, although were proper at the district court, although the district court ultimately based her decision on the wrong statute, all of the steps taken up to that point were proper. District court does not need to hold an evidentiary hearing or in other ways kind of seek additional evidence on a motion to modify parenting time that's not substantial. So in this case, the request to modify parenting time was from about 22 or 23%, I think, up to 25%. So it was not a substantial change. All of the information that the court needed to make a decision or that the parties felt the court needed was to be provided in affidavit form or exhibits rather than through an evidentiary hearing. And I think that that's what the appellant is looking for in this case. I also wanted to touch on one of the arguments that the appellant made, which was related, I believe it was the Woolsey case. I'm not sure that I got the name of that right, but the citation was 975 Northwest 2nd 502. What's different about that case compared to the case in front of the court today is that that was a motion to modify custody, meaning that if the court applied the incorrect standard, they weren't applying, they weren't giving that person, that litigant, the chance to fully prove their case through an evidentiary hearing if that was necessary. There's an analysis that on a change of custody, the court has to go through to determine whether a motion should be denied, or if not, if it should go on to an evidentiary hearing. That's a very different procedural posture than the case in front of the court today, because this motion could be granted or could be denied just after the basis of a motion hearing. So I think it's important to distinguish that as well. Similarly, with regard to the 25% parenting time argument, the court had the information needed to make that determination. Respondent is not required to specifically reference the 25% parenting time presumption in her response. The respondent provided a lot of information that was relevant to the best interest of the child determination in her response. Although the court did at least reference that, the court did not show what the application was. So our position is that the matter should be remanded back to the district court to simply make additional findings based on the record before it as to the best interest of the child and the 25% parenting time presumption. Similar, I mean, it's a similar argument all the way around with the vacation and the holiday time schedule. I think it's the same. The court had the information that it needed. I think specifically a big factor besides all the factual information is that it had been just 1 year since the parties themselves decided that what was in their children's best interest was a parenting time schedule that was less than 25% parenting time, a vacation schedule that included 1 week during each of the summer months, and a holiday schedule that included sometimes for Mother's Day, Father's Day, the children's birthdays, but specifically and intentionally did not include other holidays. The appellant's request was real general about alternating holidays, didn't specify what holidays were necessary or not. And the testimony at the motion hearing similarly did not include any other specific requests or information. Also, the argument at the hearing showed that, in fact, the party's plan to otherwise share holidays had been working, as the appellant had had plenty of time for holidays in that past year. The final issue raised is whether the district court has discretion to order that automatic deposit or automatic transfer for payment of child support and maintenance. While there's no specific authority saying, yes, this is what can be done, there is no authority that doesn't allow that. I think it's within the court's discretion to allow that. And certainly the cases show that the court has the ability to use some creative methods to ensure that payments are made timely.
Counsel, I just have a question. In the two cases that you cited, was the court relying on the statute appellant cited to us, 518A.71? In making those decisions, or in those cases, was it more analogous to this situation as opposed to a sequestration when child support isn't being paid?
I can't recall off the top of my head if there was a specific cite to our statute, I think what is shown is that the court has the ability to make sure that payments are made timely. I know that in child support matters and maintenance matters, it's a kind of utmost concern that those payments are made timely so that the person receiving payments can rely on them. And if this is a method that was going to accomplish that, it was well within the court's discretion to order it. Karen, and I know Issy, I've got about 3-4 minutes left, but I don't have anything else to add.
All right. Thank you very much for your argument, Ms. Fisher. We will now go back to Ms. Graves. Would you like to present rebuttal?
Just a couple of short comments, Your Honor. First, on the last issue, I would note that the 1985 and 1986 decisions on the money being held in trust, those were, I don't know if automatic income withholding was available at that time. I know that's around the time that the federal laws were issued, but there is a remedy now for the petitioner or for the respondent on this appeal, and that is to apply for automatic income withholding. And that's what's available. Requiring a bank to make direct, to do the direct deposits is not. I also wanted second to just make it clear, we are not asking that the court order that an evidentiary hearing be held. I agree with counsel that this is a case that is decided on affidavits, and that if it is remanded, that we would be submitting additional evidence via email or via affidavit. And on that last point, I would just state and conclude that in reviewing the affidavits that were filed by the parties, quite honestly, and again, I'm coming in, I was not my client's attorney at the time, but I don't believe that the trial court had the evidence before it to make an informed decision. The mother's affidavit, for the most part was, vilified my client and really didn't focus on the best interests of the children. And my client was pro se and probably should have focused more. And his focus was on, well, this is taking time from me because of the move. And not that that isn't important, but again, I just, for all the reasons I've stated, the trial court will benefit from having a fuller record on remand. Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments this morning. The case is now submitted to the court, and we will issue our decision within a statutory timeframe.